National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. Sometimes, we're even joined by guests from around the world. And today, two of our three guests are in the United Kingdom, and the other is in California. We're going to look at some unique aspects to the war in Ukraine this morning. Specifically, we're going to consider Russian strategic intelligence failures that led to the debacle that has been the Russian invasion of a sovereign Ukraine. And we'll look at the situation through the lens of Vladimir Putin. We have three guests to help us learn about this topic. Our first guest is Professor David Geo. David Geo is Visiting Professor of Intelligence and International Security in the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. He joined the department as a British Academy Global Professor. He's also Associate Professor of History at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where he also serves as a History Fellow for the Army Cyber Institute. David is also Director of Studies for the Cambridge Security Initiative and co-convener of its International Security and Intelligence Program. Professor Geo is experienced in civilian, military, corporate, and law enforcement intelligence with expertise in intelligence analysis and overseas operations. He holds advanced degrees from Georgetown University and the University of Cambridge. Our second guest is Dr. Hugh Dillon. Hugh Dillon is a reader in intelligence and international security at the Department of War Studies in King's College London. He's also an associated researcher at the Center for Intelligence Studies in the Norwegian Intelligence School. His work focuses on intelligence in the Cold War and beyond, with a specific focus on deception operations, intelligence in diplomacy, and covert action. He has published widely on these fields in academic journals and in the press. His first monograph, Defense Intelligence and the Cold War, was published with Oxford University Press. His latest published book was The CIA and the Pursuit of Security with Edinburgh Press, University Press. He's currently working on Writers in Intelligence, the Secret State, and the Public Sphere. Our third guest is Elena Grossfeld. Elena Grossfeld is a doctoral candidate in the Department of War Studies in King's College London and a member of King's Intelligence and Security Group. Her research interests are the strategic culture of Russian-Soviet intelligence, the Cold War, and information warfare. Elena holds a Master of Arts in Intelligence and International Security from King's College London, and a Master of Arts in Linguistics from San Jose State University, and a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics with a minor in Russian Studies from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Having started her career as a software engineer and architect, she specialized in reliability and performance of systems powering the internet and e-commerce before moving into cybersecurity, focusing on the areas of insider threat, cyber threat intelligence, and cryptocurrencies-related fraud investigations. I should highlight that the opinions expressed by all three of our guests this morning are not the official position of any government or organization. It's strictly their own. So I'd like to welcome all three of you, David Geo, Elena Grossfeld, and Hugh Dillon. Welcome to National Security This Week.
Thanks very much for having us, John.
So let's
Thank
go
you,
ahead.
John. It's a pleasure.
Yep, you bet. So Elena, you're in California, is that right?
Yes, I'm in the Silicon Valley, or the Bay Area as the locals call it, and it's just the sun is starting to come out.
All right, we caught you early this morning. And David and Hugh, you're both over in London, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Just North London, where it's cold and snowing.
That sounds a little bit like Minnesota. So we have a lot to cover today. Let's begin, if we could. And I want to talk about the catalyst for the three of you coming together, because you recently co-authored a paper on Vladimir Putin, his decision to invade Ukraine, and the flawed intelligence and use of intelligence in Putin's national security decision-making. What was it that sparked the three of you to come together to write this paper? And we'll get to the details of the paper here shortly, but let's just talk about, you know, the catalyst for the paper right now.
Sure. Well, I guess it started really with Hugh and I, as most magical things do, over WhatsApp. And just sort of, you know, Hugh and I were sort of musing on the idea right at the beginning of the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. My Ukrainian friends would, I guess, want me to say the second invasion, the first being 2014. So but we'll just use Invasion for the recent one for short. And we just sort of came up with a with what academics love to chase, which is a puzzle or a question that doesn't make any sense. And the one that we kind of came up with was that, you know, Vladimir Putin is supposed to be some sort of an intelligence god, you know, someone who's supposed to be a master strategist. And why is that? Well, very few heads of state have any background in intelligence, and even fewer actually at the working level. And Putin enjoyed that, and you know, and that background, you'd think would have conferred some sort of advantages in statecraft, and it didn't. And so Hugh and I wanted to answer the question: well, what went wrong? Putin certainly didn't get this right. And he had some of the advantages of maybe, you know, why he could have gotten it right, or why he could have at least understood the process of intelligence that would have led to better decision making. And so we wrote an op-ed back in March. I think it was published in the Washington Post on March 17th, called Putin's KGB Past Didn't Help Him with Intelligence on Ukraine. And so that was sort of the seed corn for, you know, academics never want to waste a word or waste an article. And so we thought, well, can we scale this up a little bit? I mean, can we really, you know, op-eds are terribly short. And we thought, you know, there's really is more to this. But neither Hugh nor I speak Russian, and Elena does, and is an otherwise god of social media research. And so we thought, well, you know, how can we build the right team that makes sure that we sort of understand the right sources and the right source base to really flesh out the argument properly? And so, you know, with that kernel, the three of us set to work on a longer academic piece.
Elena or Hugh, any further comments?
I can add some, because for me, when the invasion started and everybody went on social media, as Dave says, and on Twitter, and everybody was watching the second best army in the world after the U.S. Step on a rake multiple times in the like the first 3 days of the invasion, and you're watching it, and as a student of intelligence, you see all the possible errors that could have been made, all the possible mistakes that could have been done are then and there in front of you. And you're like, what the F, right? And so I wrote a short blog for the War Studies website. And I asked Hugh if he would care to look at it and say, you know, did I go too far? Did I, you know, completely lose it? And then that's when you said, oh, actually, you know, we think something very similar, and would you like to join? And of course, I jumped at the opportunity.
And Hugh, any final thoughts on this point?
Well, yeah, David and Ellen have covered it very nicely there. But there was just a puzzle in here that was really kind of fascinating, I think, to us all, and you know, to us as students of intelligence and statecraft in general, you know, about the relationship between leaders and their intelligence machinery, you know, at the most significant, important point in us, you can think of, you know, the decision to go to war. And you know, there's so much information coming out that it just seemed too good an opportunity to miss to really grapple with it.
Fair enough. So you've published this paper, and the title is The Autocrat's Intelligence Paradox, Vladimir Putin's Miss, in parentheses, Mismanagement of Russian Strategic Intelligence in the Ukraine War. And it was published in the British Journal of Politics and International Relations. First of all, my congratulations to all three of you for succeeding in getting this lengthy, exceptionally well-written and argued paper published in such a prestigious journal. What did you expect to find when you started researching this topic, and were you surprised at anything you found during your research? And I'll start with you, Hugh.
Yeah, thanks, John. I think one of the things that I sort of expected to find what was an interesting dynamic between the nature of the government, the nature of the regime, and some of the, you know, intelligence aspects that you could see in the war. I mean, that was kind of the point of entry into the topic, and you know, the sort of theory, small t, behind it was that there would be something that explained perhaps some of the weakness, poor performance, et cetera, that we'd have witnessed in many aspects of the war, tactical, operational, strategic, you know, to both domestic and in the international aspects, and that there'd be something in the nature of the regime that would help explain some of that, and that would sort of point to a solution to the puzzle that David mentioned at the top there.
And Elena?
I don't know that I necessarily had any expectations, except it can't be true, right? I mean, they're supposed to have the best intelligence, the KGB, and then the split, and you know, all the intelligence apparatus that works in Russia. And you know, in the recent years, they have not been constrained with any like democratic processes or institutions. And you look at it and you're like, no, I can't, something must be wrong, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So for me, it was, I guess, just shows my inexperience in those matters that I did not expect to see that much.
and a little bit later, I do want to ask all three of you about that very sizable apparatus of intelligence collection and analysis and whatnot that is inside Russia. But for now, let's stick with this topic. And David, any thoughts from you?
Well, I did what I tell my students not to do, and so I hope they're not listening, because I'm going to confess to something that I would yell at them for, which is, and I know this sounds terribly sort of hubristic, but I sort of knew we were right, and it was really just a question of showing our work. You know, I mean, I sort of expected to find what we found, and it was really just a matter of laying out the argument and you know, just kind of getting it out there. And, you know, I know we're supposed to go into things with a research question, you know, and then do our research to formulate a hypothesis. But, you know, I sort of turned it on its head and I tell my students, don't do it, you know, go to the library with an open mind. But I didn't do that. In terms of one thing that I did sort of learn, I think, through this process was just looking at some of the polling from Ukraine and sort of the irony that Putin actually would have been better served had he not had an intelligence apparatus at all. Like if it were just Putin and Google, I have a Russian speaking postdoc and she also speaks Ukrainian. And so she was going through some of the polling from before the invasion that looked at a bunch of stuff across Ukraine. Confidence in the government, you know, do you think Russia is a friend or a foe, or, you know, what language do you speak at home? And while there could have been some evidence that the Ukrainian people were a little bit frustrated with their government, none of the polling ever suggested that the best thing to do would be to be part of Russia again. And so the idea, you know, Putin's sort of fundamental thesis that if you just get rid of Zelensky or the Zelensky government in this sort of blitzkrieg, and then you come back, you know, and then you install your puppet, and then the Ukrainian people will be a cue. That was a close call with democracy. I'm glad we're back under Putin's wing now. You know, it would have been better for him to just have no intelligence service at all and just look at some of the basic polling, because even if it didn't dissuade him from invading, it would have at least showed him that the sort of invasion on the timeline or with the resources allotted was absolutely farcical.
Yeah. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Dr. David Geo, Dr. Hugh Dillon, and PhD candidate Elena Grossfeld. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So let's we get into our second segment here, and for this second segment, I'd like to kind of focus it on a discussion of Vladimir Putin directly. As most people know, and you've mentioned this a little bit, he was a KGB officer assigned to Europe. Then the Warsaw Pact collapsed, and 2 years later, the Soviet Union imploded. Boris Yeltsin later assigned Putin to head up the new FSB, the Federal Security Service, which partly replaced the KGB. Putin quickly rose to power, likely using his knowledge of intelligence to sort of vault past his competition, maybe to destroy his enemies and to secure his place as a future Russian president. What should we understand about Putin from his use of intelligence to secure his own power base? And why don't we start, Elena, let's start with you on this question.
Sure. I think we're going back to my favorite topic, which is strategic culture. So Putin as the KGB officer is very much a product of the organization. And as a former Soviet citizen, he is a product of Soviet education. And in both those cases, you should never be bothered when the facts don't fit your picture of reality, right? I mean, that does it doesn't mean anything. So when Dave was referring to the polls and the attempt at democracy in Ukraine, in Putin's mind and in his intelligence mind, I mean, intelligence organization's mind, this was all orchestrated, organized, and paid for by the State Department. And, you know, the expression in Russian is the State Department cookies, when I think it was Victoria Nuland was distributing some cookies to the protesters or to citizens. This is the perfect example of the payback. The fact that people are willing to risk their lives for an idea rather than for material benefits is not... it's not a good fit into their worldview. Mm. And so, you know, it should be ignored.
And David?
Well, I'm going to get back on the academic track. Got a little off putting the thesis before the research. okay. let me get back on track with terms, because we love terms and we love definitions. And I don't speak Russian, but I there are two terms that I do think are really important when we're talking about Putin. And they are Czechist and Siloviki. The term Czechist comes from the Bolsheviks secret police founded in 1917 under Felix Dzerzhinsky, called the Cheka. And what this means is, it's literally a person who is a member of the Soviet security establishment, the secret police. But more broadly, a Czechist points to an idea, and that idea. More broadly understood is that being a Czechist represents a belief system that the locus of power properly belongs to the secret state, that the secret state is the real pillar. And relatedly, the Siloviki, and so Putin is definitely a Czechist, which is where I was trying to go with that. And that really is sort of his cultural imprint. And the Siloviki are the people that surround him. They are not the oligarchs. Everyone wants to say, oh, well, the oligarchs, the mega rich people with the huge yachts, they have all the power in Russia. Not really. They have some for sure. And Putin likes their money. But the Siloviki, the heads of the intelligence and the security apparatus, and we can include the heads of the military apparatus in there. They run the show. And so Putin has surrounded himself with these people. And then just, you know, a quick, I think, a point about Putin's past is that, you know, he had always wanted to be a member of the KGB ever since he was a young boy. And there's a great story that's told by, I don't know, Catherine Belton, I think, maybe, and several others, where Putin kind of rocks up to the KGB headquarters, you know, in his hometown and says, hey, you know, can I join? And he's like 11. And they said, well, you know, drink your milk and go to university. And then one day you can come back. And he did. You know, you mentioned, John, that Putin served in Europe. But there's an important caveat there is that he served in East Germany.
Yeah.
In a sort of, well, we don't exactly know, but in a sort of counterintelligence role, not as the elite first chief directorate abroad in the West, you know, recruiting Western spies and stealing secrets. And this is an important point. You know, Putin, although he very much identifies as a Czechist and in his professional background means so much to him and personally, and I think in unlocking who he is and what he does, he was only sort of ever a middle ranking officer who was never actually trusted or honored or privileged to actually serve in the West properly. So he was always sort of in the in the Eastern Bloc.
A junior varsity player is what you're trying to say.
That's right. And I just think it's a really important touchstone as we understand what comes next.
And Hugh, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say there, isn't there, about how he's learned to use the intelligence machinery to sort of establish himself and his cronies as the real power brokers in Russia. And I suppose that one of the points that's worth mentioning, or one of the words that will feature quite prominently, something that he'll have no doubt learned in his career, is corruption. Mm-hmm. and how the power of being an intelligence officer throughout his career would have allowed him to open doors by granting privileges, by accepting bribes, by putting people in touch with other people, and by exploiting your privilege as an officer of the secret state to both enrich yourselves, to enable others, and to just consolidate yourself at the center of a web. And I think that's something you see from early on in his career, then certainly on to his time as deputy mayor, that kind of followed him along. This idea of that might be kind of a cozy, Western construct of intelligence as being this kind of noble profession to serve the state, to help decision makers make better decisions, and so on and so forth. We're thinking in a different category here. This is intelligence for power. And corruption is at the heart of it. And this is something he's learned, and this is something that he's operated throughout his career.
Yeah, and he certainly used the capabilities of the intelligence services to silence dissent from Russian voices, both internally and abroad. That's been well covered in the news. Maybe I could ask the three of you to give us a quick summary of what exactly is the intelligence apparatus that exists inside the modern day Russian government. I think it might help our listeners to understand the scope of intelligence operations that are carried out every day by Russia to provide strategic intelligence to Russian policymakers and especially to Vladimir Putin. And if you want to throw in, what the broader security apparatus is beyond just the intelligence organization, that might even be more helpful. And I'll kick it to any of you that want to start us off.
Elena wrote that section.
Maybe there we go.
Over to Elena.
Sure. So the current Russian security, state security layout is pretty much rooted in the Soviet one. So the military intelligence, which is the GRU, or now called the GU, remained unchanged, basically, and they are still in charge of military intelligence. The KGB, which prior to the dissolution or disintegration of Soviet Union was everything else, has been broken into separate pieces. The first chief directorate of the KGB that was in charge of foreign intelligence became the SVR, and the current head is Naryshkin, who was very publicly humiliated a couple of days before the invasion, for all to see. And then the everything else went into FSB, which Putin was the director of in the 90s. And so the FSB currently is responsible not only for internal security and the counterintelligence, and the protection of the constitutional order, however you want to call it, but they're also in charge of foreign intelligence in the near abroad, which is a short name for former Soviet republics. And so Ukraine would definitely be part of their portfolio.
Okay.
And I think that's basically it, unless you guys wanted to add something.
Well, I would just emphasize, Elena, what you said about the near abroad, just to make sure that that's clear and what the implications of that are for our analysis or anyone's analysis when they're looking at Russian intelligence, right? It would be like having the FBI also have, primacy for Mexico and Canada or something. And this organizational structure where the Foreign Intelligence Service isn't primarily responsible for the sovereign state of Ukraine and other sovereign states, suggests, I think, something quite significant about how the Russian apparatus and how Putin thinks about, how they conceptualize the near abroad, right? As not really, okay, fine, there's this fake line on the map, but you're all really Russian anyway. So, you know, we'll get you back one of these days. And so that organizational structure, I think, you know, while line and block charts can be tedious, I think this one really reveals something about Russian thinking about the near abroad, and in our case, in Ukraine in particular.
And Dave, if I can just bounce off that, I mean, I think that's such a good point. And you can see that mirrored elsewhere back in the past, where it's part of a reflection of an imperialist mindset, of an imperial kind of view of the world. And, like, you know, the example I think of is, you know, back in the day, you know, when the UK had its empire, security in the colonies was the responsibility of MI5, the domestic security service, you know, no matter how far flung the colony. And you know, there's like this, you know, with lots of water under the bridge and years gone by, but there's an analog here of this is a very, very telling of the kind of imperialist project, the imperialist war that is being waged.
So just from my perspective, listening to the three of you who are truly experts on this topic, the power was really given to the FSB, and it's really more for the internal security of Russia. And that's where Vladimir Putin spent the majority of his career. Probably no, it's not a strong leap to figure out that that's where he most focuses his intelligence, is on the internal security side, maybe a little less on the external. One more question before I have to take a break. For many years now, some have given Vladimir Putin a great deal of credit for masterfully playing a truly weak hand as the leader of Russia in his engagement with the world. He's had many successes over the years, quite frankly. In your research for this paper, did you uncover any situations that demonstrated Putin's skillful use of intelligence to secure these desired Russian outcomes in previous international gambits? Any of you.
I think I can go. It's not popular to give Putin any credit anymore, right? Because now we see who the Wizard of Oz is.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, the Wizard did have some decent successes, I think, when you consider, I mean, what does Russia really have going for it? Right. A half frozen petrostate, you know, with bad declining health outcomes, demographic outcomes, you know, a relatively small GDP, you know, but nuclear weapons, you know, and you know, and a domestic security service that's quite good at repression. So, you know, not nothing. But Putin, you know, to give him his due, he has punched above his weight in the international system before Ukraine. And I think we do have to acknowledge that. And further, a lot of that's actually led by his intelligence and his special operations bureaucracy. You know, he invaded Georgia relatively successfully in 2008. He intervened in the Syrian civil war. He captured Crimea. You know, land from a sovereign neighboring state with nary a shot fired in 2014. You know, meddled in Western elections. You know, not just the U.S. and not just elections, right? In ongoing sort of civil discourse. You know, and then he did it virtually consequence free by co-opting you know business executives, government leaders. You know, sweet talking the people that he needed to sweet talk, and twisting the arms of those he needed to twist. And so, when you look at the record of sort of the chaos and mayhem that he's wrought, and the really tiny price that he's paid for those activities, I think you do have to say that, you know, he was playing a pretty good hand until he wasn't.
Right. Yeah. So we have to take just a brief break, about a 60-second break, to recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We'll be right back.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back with Dr. David Geo, Dr. Hugh Dillon, and PhD candidate Elena Grossfeld talking about Russian intelligence and the invasion of Ukraine. Folks, for this third segment of our show, and by the way, we have covered the Russian invasion of Ukraine a number of times on this show. And David, to your point, it's really the second Russian invasion of Ukraine. That is a great way to frame it. Suffice it to say, the Russian offensive didn't succeed as everybody thought it would back in February of 2022, almost a year ago now. In fact, it kind of failed spectacularly. We certainly do not know how this war will end, but we know right now the Russians have paid a terrible price for inept prosecution of Putin's war aims. And it seems that Putin is really under increasing pressure in Moscow to deliver some level of success. Can the three of you comment on what Russia did to collect intelligence on Ukraine ahead of the invasion and on the collection and analysis that led to the failed early stage of the offensive? And I'll maybe ask Hugh if you would start us off.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, a lot is coming out on this. We have to preface everything we say with, we don't know exactly what went onto Putin's desk, if anything. On this point, but it seems pretty clear that they were getting a lot of stuff on, you know, the weakness of the Zelensky government, the unpopularity of the leadership there, how it's a rotten state, and how really they want to be back in the bosom of Mother Russia, like David was talking about earlier. What they seem not to have been getting, which is, it seems as interesting as what they were getting, and we'll talk about both sides of it, is good tactical intelligence. And you see very early on in the conflict a lot of examples of targets being struck that might have been targets a few decades ago during the Soviet era, but now are civilian targets and so on and so forth. I think you see a lot of mismanagement of the collection on Ukrainian military capabilities, particularly their potential to use Western hardware. And this sort of all sort of happens in the context of not asking the right question about the fundamental issue at hand, which is, what is actually going to happen if we roll over the border? So what's not being asked and what's not being collected and what's not being thought about is in a way far more important than what is being collected and so on and so forth.
And Elena?
I think for me, the most striking thing is, as you said, they did not ask themselves what's going to happen when they roll over the border. As a site reliability engineer, the first thing you think about when you plan some sort of a change or some sort of operation is that what can go wrong, right? I mean, it's called pre-mortem, and you do it for a reason, to figure out what you know, what you don't know, what you think you don't know, and all the parts that go in it. So it's really surprising that there was apparently nobody to say, hey, there's a bunch of things we don't know, or if there was such a person or such a unit or whatever, it never bubbled up. And that is reflected in what in the leaks that the founder of gulagu.net site received, in that the analysis has to conform to what your boss expects. And the questions being asked of analysts is, this is what we like. You don't even give them the correct details of what you're planning to do so they can address the issue. And as for tactical intelligence failures, if you look at, for example, the space assets of the Russian Federation that are fed into the military intelligence, it is very little surprise that they could not identify targets, because they have now two optical reconnaissance satellites that are working. The rest of them are being launched and like falling down, like, I don't know, I mean, pick the right analogy, but there is nothing that even compares to the Western intelligence capabilities. And so when the Russian soldiers had to rely on Soviet road atlases to navigate in Ukraine, I mean, very little else that you can say about that.
Yeah. And David?
Yeah, I had written before before, and before, I mean, you know, before working with Elena in particular, that, you know, that Putin was sort of more of the same, you know, that he was, you know, just another Soviet, whatever. And Elena had corrected that for this piece. And I think that was an important, you know, revision that we made, because he's actually worse from the intelligence point of view. And the reason is because of what Hugh has already said, which is the corruption. And the culture of corruption was so pervasive that, you know, there were fictitious assets, you know, fictitious human sources where, you know, you're not paying sources, or you're paying them, you know, and pocketing most of the money, and they don't need to have any expenses, or that, you know, you don't need to run a proper agent network, because you already know that the outcome is pre-cooked or predetermined. And so, you know, there's a level of intellectual corruption, you know, as well as actual corruption, and because the process is so distorted. And I think it's worth just sort of zooming back out on why it's, you know, why should we feel so sorry for these autocrats dealing with intelligence, you know? And it's because it gets to the very nature of what intelligence is for. You know, as Hugh mentioned, it's to narrow the cone of uncertainty, or as Elena said, you know, to do some kind of premortem to say, hey, what could go wrong? In the U.S., you know, as an intelligence professional, you know, I want my bosses to be informed and to understand the world better. And in an autocratic regime, the word intelligence just doesn't mean foreknowledge of the enemy or any of these classical definitions of intelligence that we like to bat around. It really means securing the party or securing the Politburo, or in Putin's case, or, you know, Kim Jong-un's case, or Saddam Hussein's case, you know, to secure the power and the personhood of the leader. And how you do that is by crushing dissent and by removing political rivals, like Boris Nemtsov, you know, shot in the back, or like just right outside the Kremlin, or any of the journalists, you know, Anna Politkovskaya, you know, murdered on Putin's birthday. And so that's really where the emphasis lies. And so they have this behemoth, but the behemoth isn't focused on the things that we in the West would sort of think that it might be focused on. And this approach to intelligence and security leads also, I think, to bad outcomes, because it's not evidence-based, as both of my co-authors have said. It's based on, you know, what Putin wants to hear. And Elena had already mentioned that, you know, when you have a bunch of sycophants, you're setting the conditions for your bureaucracy to not serve you well. You know, and again, I think as Elena mentioned, when Putin was asking his national security establishment, you know, hey, should we go, no go, and Naryshkin was like, oh, maybe, I don't know, and then Putin you know, really sort of laid into him, and some would say, you know, it takes being in Naryshkin's mind to know if he's humiliated or not, but certainly everyone saw what happened. And so, and look, and even the head of the Fifth Department, which was responsible for Ukraine, was actually briefly arrested. And I don't think we quite know what that means. He was subsequently let go. So I don't think we know exactly enough to say for sure. But, you know, I guess the point is, you know, are the agencies to blame? Yeah, in part, they sure are, because they're cooking the books for Putin. But at the end of the day, and as I think the article points out, you know, Putin is the one who wants the books cooked in a certain way, and they know the recipe, and so that's I think how we ended up where we are.
So not only is dissent not allowed in speaking out against Putin as the leader, but even within the security establishment, the intelligence establishment, dissent from whatever the decision that's been made is also not allowed. Is that what I'm hearing inside Russia?
I think that's a fair summing up of it, broadly speaking. I mean, and you know, the, you probably wouldn't want to make a sweeping statement about that being true in all times at all places. But when it comes to Ukraine, there's clearly a particular itch there that Putin wanted to scratch. And to put it crudely, and you look at his essay, that tract he wrote, on the historical unity of Ukraine in the Russian peoples, or words to that effect, setting out in rather a weird way his view on the matter. I mean, you can see pretty clearly that this is not a topic that is going to welcome pushback on. For example, if the poor, mid-level career officer X wants to maybe ever so gently suggest up the chain that this isn't going to go as well as the master of the Kremlin thinks. There's clearly a space there that people aren't going to want to go, given the frequency with which people get pushed out of windows or meet untimely ends and that kind of stuff. So and it's this, what's quite interesting in the case is this kind of chronic lack of self-awareness that Putin has, where he's clearly, he must know that his system is corrupt because he's been engaged in the corruption and he presumably had to play this game at some point in his career, but he clearly hasn't been able to see that now, as the manager of that system, he's built himself this rotten platform on which to, on which to place his legacy. And now he's kind of, furiously trying to, flap his arms as he's falling down off the edge of the cliff, or to mix my metaphors.
So let me ask you this. So the first question here that I just asked you on this topic is with the decisions that led up to the invasion, the poor intelligence, the poor decision making on Putin's part. Do the three of you, since you've done this research, do you see Russian intelligence learning from their early failures ahead of the war and the early days of the war? We're almost a year into the conflict now. Are the Russians getting better at this point in assessing Ukraine's center of gravity or Ukrainian command and control capabilities, tactics, or anything else of tremendous importance in time of war? Are the Russians learning from their mistakes?
Well, I think it would be reasonably safe to say that in certain ways they are, because they are adapting in how they're fighting, just learning to stay out of the range of HIMARS, etc., learning how to how to survive a little bit better. Whether or not Putin's decision making is improving owing to intelligence reports, or whether or not the bureaucracy is functioning as you might wish your intelligence bureaucracy to function, I would suggest the jury's still out on that, because it doesn't seem that important a thing to him. And what he wants to do clearly is secure some kind of legacy point out of this. And a report saying it's not going as well as we'd like, and the West appears to be holding, and oh look, there's more tanks coming, and that they're going to have this effect on our capacity to fight, it probably still isn't that welcome.
Mm-hmm. Elena, yeah, or David?
I would agree with that.
Yeah,
I think they are getting better. I mean, they must be learning on the tactical level, right? And because there were many reports of successful FSB use of Telegram app tracking in the occupied territories. And there were actually yesterday or the day ago, a report about the coordinated nature of cyber attacks with, military attacks. But the one, even on a tactical level, the problem that remains is the disconnect and the miscommunication between the different branches of intelligence. So, for example, for artillery and missile directions, the FSB gets results from people, squeezing out of them, inspecting their phones, torturing them and whatever. But then they can't pass it on to the intelligence units so they can correct intelligence, because they're saying, oh, yeah, next to Kharkov, there is some Ukrainian position, and the people who are in charge of it are saying, okay, where exactly next to Kharkov? And they're like, oh, somewhere there, which is not exactly how intelligence works when you're trying to correct your artillery, but they will not allow access to the prisoners from the other units. And so they're still each stuck in their silo without ability to properly communicate or like effectively communicate. So there are some improvements on tactical level, but I think I agree with you and David that on, you know, upper layers, it's still, everything is fine.
It might be worth saying something about their counterintelligence posture, because I see them still making the same mistakes that they've done previously. And some of those, I think, are ignorance, and some of those are they just don't have it. The ignorance one, for instance, would be, you know, conscripts, you know, not being properly instructed to not, let's say, you know, tag their, you know, social media geo-tagged pictures, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that caused the Wagners or conscripts, I can't remember, some grief. Not too long ago, because the Ukrainians are seeing this, and this is wonderful targeting intelligence that you know, certainly they're not making Ukrainians work hard for. And the second one, I think, is you know, one thing they just can't do is they don't have enough encrypted radios to communicate, and so the Ukrainians, you know, even if they know that they shouldn't be speaking in the clear, they are. Because they just don't have the equipment to do it properly. And so from a counterintelligence point of view, even if they've now learned the lesson, they can't seem to fix it in a timely manner.
Yeah. For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guests today are Dr. Hugh Dillon, Dr. David Geo, and PhD candidate Elena Grossfeld. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. We're in the final quarter of our show this morning. Your article discusses Russian strategic intelligence failures and Putin's failure, frankly, in not anticipating the unified response from the West to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and frankly, from the world. Can you go in a little more detail on that point? Why do you think Putin so badly miscalculated the response from both NATO and the EU, two separate entities but very closely aligned, as well as other nations that have condemned his actions in the invasion? And David, let's go ahead and start with you.
Sure. You know, this is where I think from a certain perspective, one could forgive Putin for getting this wrong, because history was sort of on his side, actually. And so
I agree.
If you're looking at a trend analysis, you know, I already sort of gave you the greatest hits of Putin's rap sheet. But, you know, look, I mean, the EU and the U.S. didn't respond in any real way to any number of outrages. I can't even remember the rap sheet that I gave, you know, assassinating people in Berlin parks. You know, it was just the, you know, poisoning people, you know, Alexander Litvinenko, you know, as far back as 2006 with polonium-210 in London. And, you know, the British establishment was like, oh, that's a shame, but there's an awful lot of Russian money filtering through our law firms and our banks, you know, and our luxury car dealers and our real estate sector. So, you know, what's a defector? Let's leave this to go on. And that was actually the same response after the invasion in 2014. When one of my favorite paparazzi pictures, which is not a phrase I say a lot, but there was a guy with a really long telephoto lens, and you know there's classified information cover sheets for a reason, and a guy left a National Security Council meeting at number 10 Downing Street, and he didn't put his notes under a cover sheet, and a photographer got a picture of it. And what it said was, we're not going to basically do anything. We're not going to close the city of London, aka banking, to the Russians as a result of this. And I think that sort of, you know, let you know that, you know, there was no appetite, you know, sanction here, sanction there. And then it went worse. Instead of ignoring it, you know, in 2018. When then President Trump met Putin in Helsinki, and Putin was like, you know, I didn't do anything. It wasn't me. And Trump said, well, you know, I don't see why it would be him, when, you know, when his intelligence community was, you know, screaming till they were blue in the face, that it was. And so, you know, if you're Putin, you're almost in a casino thinking, I can't place a bad bet here. You know, and then all of a sudden he did place a bad bet. And just when he thought there's really nothing I can do that would get the West organized, that would get the West's act together. And then he found the thing that he could do that did get their act together. And so, you know, I get it, you know, from Putin's perspective, I understand why he thought the way he thought, and he had reason to think that. Fortunately, from my own, you know, perspective, you know, the West finally woke up and said, okay, that's enough.
Elena.
Yeah. I mean, the view of Putin as this benevolent agent goes back to even Bush, I think, who said he looked into his eyes and saw his soul. I don't know how far he looked, but I doubt that there is any there. But the other thing is the fact that Russian intelligence, Russian siloviki, Russian establishment views the West as basically the same as Russia, in that, you know, the civil society is weak, and the governance is corrupt, and all the institutions are there just for show, and they don't realize. And I think it goes back to the Cold War, where Soviet ambassador would demand of the Washington Post not to publish something, or would try to tell the administration, tell your newspapers not to write it. And the administration would say, we can't do that. You know, this is not how it's done. And the Soviets were sure that it's a lie. Of course you do that, but you do it for your own reasons, and you don't do it for us, which is, you know, you're the bad guy. So this perception this view of your adversary through the lens of what you know is true has been going on forever. And it has been going in the West as well, right? Because everybody thought, you know, 1991, Soviet Union is gone. Immediately, everybody will jump feet first into democracy, and institutions would spring up, and, you know, political actorship and engagement will prevail in the society. That didn't happen, and there's still a big divide between the two parts. And I don't know that it's likely to change anytime soon, but, you know, maybe you has a more optimistic view.
Hugh, what do you think?
I don't have a more optimistic view, and I'm a little bit less generous, I think, than for the sake of argument, than David is on this point of this being a forgivable mistake or an understandable mistake on Putin's part. I mean, I think this is a mistake that you make when you create a system and manage a bureaucracy that only really does what you want, you know, does something in accordance with what the boss already kind of thinks or knows, and that there was plenty of evidence that would suggest that the West would be more peeved and more united than, you know, your perception of them as a decadent sort of latte drinking, do nothing collective, or, you know, of softies would have indicated. I mean, you look to the kind of growing momentum of reaction following MH17, following the ramping up of forces, the increased flow of weapons, the increased flow of training, the increased packages of sanctions following, you know, successive outrage, the expulsion of X, Y, Z number of intelligence officers following the Skripal case, the diplomatic fallout following the poisoning, the poisonings, the spies and so on. I mean, all of this seems to point to me that, well, the West is taking what we're doing reasonably seriously, and it's escalating. And this then culminates, of course, in the West being willing to put its cards on the table as forces are building up, saying, look, we know what you're doing. We basically have your plan. You are going to invade. Please stop it. Dear world, look what's going on. We are denying you the element of surprise. So I don't think that he should have been surprised following all of that, that there was a unified reaction. And of course, what he did as well was that he forgot that the Ukrainians would have a say in this, and
Right.
that they would be on TV, on Twitter, and whatever, saying, "Hello, we're being invaded. Can you know, is anybody going to help us out here?" And you know, what's going to happen at that point? I think this is an avoidable mistake on his part, and he's fallen into it because he's drank his own Kool-Aid.
And I'm going to add two comments for you. One is last fall we had a number of shows on the U.S. intelligence community. We had John Darby, who was the former director of operations for NSA, join us live in the studio. We had the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security, the Honorable Mr. Ron Moultrie. And we also had the Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Scott Barrier. And all three of those individuals were obviously in the room for many of the discussions about delivering intelligence to not only the Biden administration and the various elements of the National Security Council, but also America's allies and partners around the world. And the sequencing that they talked about of sharing intelligence with all of the governments that were on board with speaking out against Putin was dramatic. I mean, a dramatic amount of sharing of information, allowing the diplomats to sequence the response from each of the countries, so it was a unified voice. The other thing I'll comment on, you just mentioned that Ukrainians have a say in the matter, right? I have been astounded at the messaging discipline of every single individual that's ever gotten on a television camera in Ukraine about their unified calls for what it is they face and what they need from the West and the rest of the world to help them defend democracy against this invasion by the Russians. So the title of your article speaks volumes about this overall topic, the autocrat's intelligence paradox. What lessons should listeners learn from Russia's strategic intelligence failures and Putin's failure to apply intelligence, even as a career intelligence practitioner, as we go forward? And are there any instructive lessons? And this is, you know, for America, for American political leaders, instructive lessons that American leaders should take from this case study. And unfortunately, we're closing in towards the end of the hour. I'm going to ask our station owner if we can go just maybe an extra 5 minutes or so. But let's get to this question, and then I'll ask all of you to sort of give us some closing thoughts. And Hugh, why don't we start with you?
To keep it relatively short as time runs away from us, I mean, we decided on the autocrat's intelligence paradox as a title because it seemed to be a strange thing that these creatures survive in their job because they have this extensive and pervasive and well-funded and capable intelligence apparatus. But the more they do that, the sort of thinner the base of the pyramid gets and the more likely it is to tip over. And the main takeaway is, dear leaders, don't put yourself in that situation. And one of the ways I think that you can ensure not putting yourself in that situation is to reflect perhaps on the statement that the former chief of SIS, MI6, Sir Maurice Oldfield, on what he told, I think it was James Callaghan, the foreign secretary, when they first met, and he was asked, "Oh, so what's your job then?" And his response was, "Sir, my job is to bring you unwelcome news." And I think, you know, as a leader, you need a Maurice Oldfield.
Elena?
I think also from the experience of the Israeli intelligence after the Yom Kippur War, where they had to set up a separate department that will counter the analysis of the mainstream intelligence, in that, it broadens your perspective and sets your filters wider so you can be more more able to receive unwelcome news, but also to interpret them correctly. And I think we should start worrying when Russian intelligence fixes their analysis section, because right now it's not, it cannot be compared to their active measures or operations or intelligence gathering. And it has always been their weak point. And, it's probably likely to remain like that for the foreseeable future, as long as there is an autocrat on top of it.
Yeah. And David.
I would emphasize that theme in that, intelligence assessments, if we're looking at the West, and I'll just speak for the U.S. in particular, because that's what I know. But I suspect the UK and other Western governments are similar, is that intelligence assessments are offered in good faith, as Hugh suggested, even if it's not what the leader wants to hear or what's expecting to hear. And it's such an important difference, you know, and I think we need to really sort of understand the professional expertise and have educated intelligence consumers, you know, because a lot of times people get put in these positions where they are now consumers of intelligence, but they don't know what it can do for them. They don't know the limits of intelligence. And I think we, instead of just rocking up and being like, hey, here's your brief, you know, what is intelligence? What can it do for you? I think that's really important. But I also wanted to say something about the role of the USIC at the working level, because there were two questions. First is Putin going to invade? And if so, when? And then second, can the Ukrainians last? And so we should pat ourselves on the back in the IC for getting the first one really dead on. But we actually made the same analytical error that Putin did. Putin thought that the Ukrainians couldn't last, and we thought that as well. And you mentioned having Lieutenant General Barrier on your show, the DIA director, and he said, I believe, in public testimony that hey, we got that wrong. And it gets about the will to fight. And so, you know, how do you assess a country's will to fight? And of course, you know, John, you and I spent our time of service, you know, in the Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, you know, where nobody wants to fight. And so you give them all, you lavish all of this training and resources on them. And then at the first whiff of a bullet, everybody's like, I'm out of here. Right. And so I think it's a longer conversation, but I think that we might have let those experiences over the last 20 years in the so-called GWAT color our assessment of the Ukrainians, and we got it wrong. But the point is now, I think, number one, we're fixing it. And number two, as General Barrier said, look, we've got some homework to figure out how we do a better job assessing people's will to fight from an intelligence perspective.
Yep. And we're closing in on the end of the show here. I'd like to ask each of you for just maybe 1 minute, final thoughts on your article or on Russian intelligence failures, the situation in Ukraine, whatever you'd like to share with our listeners. Elena, I'd like to start with you.
Sure. I just hope that, you know, the collective West continues to support Ukraine, and the news about the German agreement to send the tanks is very welcome. And, you know, the U.S. Stating that they're going to send their own Abrams is also. And I just hope that other states around the world, namely Israel, will do a better job of supporting Ukraine and not thinking that being on the good side of Russia means anything, right? Because it's not.
Right.
There are no good sides of Russia to be in.
And Hugh.
Yeah, thanks. I'd simply echo Eleanor's comment there. And I suppose I'd say that in a sense that there is a good news intelligence story here. And though I think the West has used intelligence very well in marshalling its own population, broadly speaking, to support its actions, diplomatic and military, in the face of Russian aggression. And I think there are lessons here that should be learnt about, you know, intelligence and how it can, you know, be used effectively, and not just in the secret world, but in the public realm, to enhance public debate, public discourse, in the face of, you know, really, really nasty and brutal invasions.
And David.
Thanks. I think two quick points. The first is that, you know, for the U.S. intelligence community, I want to see us get away from the idea that where the secret information is where the answers are. And writing this article and all the work, you know, at least that I've done, suggests that, you know, the delta between what happens in the secret facility and what outside experts know is closing really fast.
It is.
You know, the people that have the clearance and the people that don't, I bet you they would probably have similar assessments. And, you know, certainly there are exquisite collection capabilities that still exist, and it's not the same. But at the strategic and maybe even the operational level, you know, reading what the Institute for the Study of War or some really good Twitter threads are putting out, I think shows you, secrets are not the key to understanding what's going on anymore. And then just, I guess, maybe to end on a personal note, I was actually getting ready to retire when from the reserves. when Ukraine started, when the Ukraine war kicked off here. And it actually gave me sort of a new lease on life, I think, and a new meaning, because here we have, and you know, as Elena said, you know, a clear aggressor, a clear aggrieved party, war crimes. You know, this isn't just some, this is a messy civil war, and maybe we should get involved, but oh, maybe we shouldn't, and I don't want to own the civil war, and should we have the National Guard, you know, with boots on the ground around some place we don't understand? You know, this is a very clear question. You know, how do we know when wars end in the Middle East or in East Africa? We have no idea, but we know that the war ends in Ukraine. You know, it's just the question: are there Russians on Ukrainian territory? Yes. Okay, we're not done. Are they on Ukrainian territory? No. Okay, we're finished. And that sort of, you know, as a 23-year practitioner, I've never had that kind of clarity in my career. And so having this kind of moral clarity, I think, is important. And I think why the West and, you know, people on social media and even, you know, average citizens are still very, very, very engaged in supporting Ukraine, because it shouldn't be a hard call at all. And I think what we can do as scholars is use this access that we have to write about understanding the war and its intelligence dimensions. And I think that can be a part of our contribution.
That is a fantastic summary from all three of you. Thank you. Unfortunately, we have hit the hard stop here for our show today. Dr. David Geo, Dr. Hugh Dillon, and doctoral candidate Elena Grossfeld, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been great.
Thank you, John. And thanks to Andrew Cotilla for linking us up.
That's right. That's right. And that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining me today, and look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. I do want to give a quick shout-out to my friend Ed Lord. I wish him a speedy and full recovery. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.